Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Autism Stories. I'm your host, Doug Bletcher, the founder of Autism Personal Coach. Autistic people are the true experts of the autistic experience, and Autism Stories is where we interview autistic people to learn from their stories, experiences, and get their insights. If you would like to be notified about each week's episode of Autism Stories, we suggest you subscribe on your favorite podcast listening platform. We would also appreciate it if you could give us a positive rating and review, as it will help others to learn about Autism Stories. On today's episode, Neurocosmos joins me to discuss producing an all-disabled drag show and how synagogues can help in building a better future for disabled trans people. We hope you enjoy today's conversation. Neuro, thanks so much for joining me today.
Of course, I'm happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me on.
And I wanted to start by learning, where does your story in the autistic community begin?
Yeah, it's definitely been a long journey to get to where I am now. I grew up in an environment that viewed autism as a horrible thing that had to be eliminated slash couldn't be visible or seen. Being autistic in that environment was viewed as separate from me instead of being viewed as part of my personhood. I was expected to present as a non-autistic person 24/7 and prevented from stimming. And because of that, I was raised with deep shame and self-hatred about being autistic. It wasn't until I was 17 years old that I learned autistic acceptance existed, that there is autistic community and culture. I discovered blog posts and essays from autistic trans people, especially from Lydia XZ Brown, that showed me what autistic community and culture can look like and that we're living beautiful, meaningful lives. Beginning my autistic community story meant dismantling everything I was taught and walking from the environment I grew up in. My disabled autistic story from there is creating openly disabled spaces in places that didn't have them before, and bringing together disabled neurodivergent people to create those spaces. When I was in college, I co-founded my college's first disabled students organization and was president for 4 years, and that organization is still around at my college. During college and the first year after I graduated from it, I was in DC disability rights spaces as an intern. And one of the highlights of my experience was being alum of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network's leadership program for autistic college students. I learned a lot of important advocacy skills from my time in DC disability rights spaces that I continue to use today, but that world ended up not being the right fit for me personally. Discovering DC drag community, especially the neurodivergent, trans, Black, Indigenous, Latina drag queens and artists, creating and transforming our community, made me realize that I want to create disability justice drag performances and make space for disabled drag artists that haven't existed in DC before. The disability rights spaces I was in at that time was not able to hold that, but my drag community, it has been able to hold me in that way. So I would say my autistic community story has been from deep self-hatred to college student organizing to learning in disability rights spaces to back to organizing in spaces that haven't had disabled spaces before. So around that journey, I feel I've learned where my skills lie.
I love hearing that because it seems like a story of a lot of self-growth.
Yeah, I've grown a lot just in within 2 years.
Now, you work at Neighborhood Access, and one of the things that Neighborhood Access is doing is currently working with and training economic development and entrepreneurship incubators and funders on making their services accessible. So I'd love to know what's specifically your role in all this.
Yeah. So for people who don't know, that Neighborhood Access is a 100% disabled-led accessibility consulting organization. Of both me and my boss are neurodivergent and trans, and what a Neighborhood Access assists with consulting projects with nonprofits, to political organizing groups, to small businesses, to incubators, making their work accessible both physically and culturally. So currently, I think I've been the social media manager of Neighborhood Access for a couple of years, and I've also, with this current project, moved into assisting my boss with the consulting arm. So Neighborhood Access is currently working with economic development and entrepreneurship funders and incubators in New Hampshire to create more accessible services for their clients. And with that current project, I'm assisting the director with trainings and presentations for those organizations. And I've been taking the lead on doing the neurodivergent accessibility specific training for those organizations and compiling and putting together neurodivergent accessibility resources for those organizations to look at, and eventually, like down the line, putting together a document of neurodivergent accessibility best practices. A lot of the important things that have come out from this for me is a lot of the clients of sort of the disabled entrepreneurs that they're working with are people with mental health disabilities. So I've been really working on expanding neighborhood accessibility, on supporting mental health disability access. And so a lot of it has been teaching the funders and incubators that mental health disability accommodations at work and developmental disability accommodations at work, like, overlap, and a lot of them, like, work across the spectrum. And also helping them understand that substance use struggles are disability, are mental health. And that's something that a lot of people with substance use struggles, like, are often, like, their main clients. But viewing substance use struggle as a disability has been a new framework that for them that's been helping them, like, expand, like, their understanding of what access looks like.
Now, as autistic people, something that I think many of us think a heck of a lot about is making the world a better place. And we look to advocate for a better world online in regards to social media, but often I'm not sure how successful we truly are with this. So from what I understand, you specialize, like you were talking about a little bit earlier, in social media and activism. What would be some ways, if someone wanted to start to be an activist on social media, that you think would more likely lead to better results or the results that they're looking for?
That's a good question. Like, with my neighborhood access work and my drag, I'm generally not approaching it with the framework of, like, I am a social media activist. I'm not placing, like, a certain, like, label on myself. My framework with using social media is, how do I use social media to expand our community? What drew me to social media was that at its core, it's about connection. And I think so is activism. The principle of both is to connect people to each other and expand community, so that when we are advocating liberation, we're doing that together, not as individuals alone. So what I'm more going to answer this question as is more like specific strategies that one can use and using social media as one of the strategies, like in your toolbox. With Neighborhood Access, I was their first social media manager. I built their social media following by sharing other organizations and activists' posts on our Instagram stories and tweets, and being like, this is an important post, and or thank you for this post, and tagging the organization and activist in our Instagram story or quote or repost. And most of the, in the vast majority of the time, the organization activists will not just interact with our story, but also follow us back. It seems more daunting to initiate the interaction, but something that I found to be easier than in-person interaction at times. But it's you're making the connections by sharing what other people are doing and not just your own. And this strategy not only built up Neighborhood Access's following, but also led to an outreach partnership for an event. It led to Neighborhood Access getting to sign on to policy letters that affected national disability policy. With drag, it's been a combination of expanding my community in person and using social media. As a drag artist, I have to use social media really, really all the time to engage. So a lot of it is that I do share, use important current events and education and mutual aid, on my Instagram stories when I'm organizing events. In addition to promoting it on my posts and stories, I also directly DM people invitations to come to events, and that helps people feel more connected to what you're doing when you directly reach out to them individually. Finally, the other thing I'll say has applied to both Neighborhood Access and drag is really brushing up and developing your graphic design abilities. I use Canva a lot, and having the aesthetically good visuals to, whether in your posts or your videos, they're also accessible. It looks good, but most importantly, it should also be easy to read. But those visuals, in addition to your words, the visuals are essential in communicating your vision so that people are drawn to it. So I think thinking of social media as a strategy with specific ways to communicate your message, I think is a helpful way of framing it as contributing to making the world a better place rather than operating from the framework of I am a social media activist.
You've referenced this throughout our conversation about being involved in drag. And something really cool that you're involved with is being the host and producer for Disabled Delight, Washington, D.C.'s All Disabled Drag Show. You're known as the Flaming Drag Artist of D.C., here to neuroqueer our universe. How do you go about neuroqueering our universe with your show, Disabled Delight?
I really love the way that you've framed this question. So thank you for that. First of all, to kind of preface this, so September will, when this podcast probably comes out, will mark 1 year of drag that I've performed in. Before I debuted in September of last year, I was going out as a frequent audience member and creating friendships in our community. And I was encouraged by my drag artist friends to become a drag king myself. So I want to acknowledge that support of my drag community was really essential to opening the door for Disabled Delight. I want to give a shout out to Desiree Dick, who is a prominent Latina drag queen in DC, who offered me the space and resources to produce my own show. I will say it is not typical to produce your own recurring show that less than a year into drag. what happened is I think I created disabled delight, and like because I dreamed of a space where disabled drag artists in DC can exist as ourselves, and my drag community recognize that disabled drag artist spaces are needed, and we need to fill that space. And people like Desiree took actions that opened the door for me to do that. Now, in both of those, both my vision and the support are big reasons why I was able to create the show. I think in terms of how I neuroqueer the universe with disabled delight, I think neuroqueer was created as a verb first and an adjective second, so the same way that queer is a verb and an adjective. So when I neuroqueer the universe, my hope is to disrupt the neuronormative and cis heteronormative society that we live in the same way that, and that queering the universe disrupts cis heteronormative society. I would say there are four ways that I aspire to do that with disabled delight specifically. Is that way one is that the show title of disabled delight, putting the word disabled front and center. There were some people that like were definitely uncomfortable that I chose that as the show title. A couple people asked me, why didn't you like choose accessible delight for the show name? And I'm just like, I'm good at creating catchy titles. But I think from the wider perspective, disabled is often viewed as a bad word, and that view was created by abled people, not disabled community. For me, calling the show Disabled Delight was reclaiming disabled community power over that word and the origins of our community. Then I think having all disabled casts with our shows, the first ever Disabled Delight show was in April. So we did an Autism Acceptance Month premiere show, and we had an all autistic drag artist cast putting on a show, and all of us were trans, so it was an autistic trans extravaganza. And then in July, our second show, July is Disability Pride Month, so we ensured an all disabled cast once again, and we're currently prepping for September. The artists and our cast are free to perform whatever they want, whatever two numbers they want to get to perform and share with disabled community in our space. They're free to do that. So neuroqueering the universe involves giving the artists I cast that expansive freedom. I let artists know that they can use the words and language they're comfortable using for their experience. Many artists I cast in the show don't use the word disabled for themselves personally, and a lot of that has to do with it being, we live in a society that's not safe for Black, Indigenous, Latina artists to be openly disabled. But the artists I cast who don't use that for themselves, or use disabled for themselves personally, know that they're part of the disability canopy, and that Disabled Delight is a show for them. So it was also about meeting people where they're at and letting them lead the way on their exploration of disabled community. Like access, a lot of drag spaces venues for drag are not accessible for disabled people. And so the space that Disabled Delight is held in is one of very few that is wheelchair accessible, and also one of the few that regularly offers, so in Disabled Delight regularly offers ASL interpretation at every show. We do not use strobe, the venue does not use strobe lights at all, and we provide KN95 masks and just and earplugs for audience members. So it's also about having expansive understanding of ensuring collective access for the performers, and having that is still radical in a lot of drag venues and in the queer spaces that we're in. And finally, I would say racial equity in casting in terms of what I aspire to do. If you aren't practicing racial justice, you're not practicing disability justice. You're not neuroqueering the universe. So with Disabled Delight, at least 50% of, I think I would say, counting me, there's 4 drag artists performing. At least 2 cast members will always be Black and drag artists of color. Either half of the cast will be drag artists of color, or I'll be the only white person. In the future, I will intentionally be expanding Disabled Delight to have disabled drag artists of color be hosts of the show as well. So a lot of neuroqueering the universe is not just like not just me like hosting and producing the show, but also creating space for disabled drag artists of color who are the forefront of our DC drag community to step in, and I pass the mic to them.
Now, you're also part of the New Synagogue Project, in which you're the co-producer of Drag Torah Time, which is a family-friendly, queer-centered drag performance of some of your favorite Torah stories. How might these Torah stories be told different through the lens of Drag Torah Time?
I love getting asked about how my disabled identity and my Jewish identity intertwine. So I think I'll preface that Drag Torah Time will premiere in October. And New Synagogue Project is a non-denominational synagogue in DC that is committed to providing a spiritual home for people who want to explore Jewish community and have struggled to find Jewish spaces that accept them. So, example, providing a home for disabled Jews, Jews of color, Jewish people who are against the occupation of Palestine. And our congregation leadership is majority queer. Significant amount of people in our congregation are trans, so it's also very much a centering of queer trans justice. Our synagogue, and I've been a member for, I think, a little over half a year. So the community leadership at the synagogue works as board members leading teams. So I'm a board member and co-leader of the synagogue's access team. And with Drag Torah Time, the leader of the synagogue's queer space and the leader of the synagogue's kids team approached me with the idea of, when they were thinking about collaborating together, they wanted to see a Jewish drag show that Jewish queer kids and adults see ourselves in. And so they wanted me to do that. I immediately invited my fellow Jewish trans drag artist family, Baphomet, who is an incredible gender-bending drag artist in DC, to be my co-producer. So Drag Torah Time is different from a drag story time. And Baphomet and I are performing the story. We're not reading a story aloud. We are creating our take on the story together. We're choosing the songs we lip sync to and writing the spoken parts. So we're really like acting out the story for families. I think in terms of how we tell the stories, for me, it's not necessarily about telling the Torah stories differently. We're bringing out what's already in the story and shining a queer light on it. Like, Judaism has a Hebrew blessing for seeing a rainbow, so we've always been queer in some form. Asking questions, wrestling with your personal identity, leaving your home on a journey to an unknown land are queer themes, queer stories. So Baphomet and I aim to tell Torah stories by choosing stories that already give us the space to tell it as a Jewish trans story. In the future, Drag Torah Time will expand to Baphomet and I inviting drag artists in our community as as guests to perform. Because the synagogue is majority white Jews working to center racial justice in its values, and Baphomet are two white Jewish people performing in a majority black indigenous Latina drag community, and the very few Jewish drag artists in our community are all white, it's essential to center black indigenous Latina Asian artists in everything we do. Telling these stories also means that we intentionally expand Jewish queer community to invite drag artists of color in our community to create performances in our events as well, about how the common themes in the Torah stories that we're sharing resonate with their lived experiences and culture as well.
I read where you wrote, "I'm a gloriously autistic trans mask queer Jewish drag king," and that you dream of a world where all disabled trans people are liberated from the oppressions that seek to erase from their existence. So in thinking about this, are there ways that synagogues can help us move towards this wonderful dream?
Yeah, for context, so that's a quote from the post where I introduced Neurocosmos to the world in June last year. So I actually wrote that before I started performing and before I started going to synagogue. I was thinking about disabled trans liberation as a whole, and I really love the idea of taking that and addressing that to synagogues specifically, because the whole world as a whole is very, very big. So I think for me, there are three ways I think for the synagogues can move us towards disabled trans liberation. I think for ways that synagogues need to create pathways to synagogue leadership for disabled Jews, trans Jews, Jews of color, Sephardic Jews, and Arab Jews. And we don't require leadership to look like being a rabbi or having to go to rabbinical school or like being certified necessarily as a cantor, that we root that in because academic pathways are often a barrier to leadership, for requiring academia is a barrier to leadership. Having expansive view of leadership that's more centered in community, having multiple pathways for community members rather than leadership going to a very small select few. Ensuring in all aspects of spiritual life that disabled trans people get to physically share their Torah at services. A lot of synagogues, their bimas or podiums that you come up to speak are elevated, and it's not accessible to wheelchair users who need a ramp. And that right there, if your path to your bima is not, your podium is not accessible, then so many people are being prevented from sharing the Torah inside them. It means disabled trans people creating our own spaces within the synagogue where we get to be ourselves, because dreaming our spaces by and for us into being is what allows us to envision what liberation looks like for us. We're writing our own blessings. We're creating those spaces already. Give us even more space to do that. I think a core second way for synagogues to move forward is practicing disability justice and trans justice by centering those values as a collective responsibility that enriches the whole congregation. Too much of the time, implementing collective access practices such as having ASL interpreters, food options for people who are allergic to gluten, having gender-neutral bathrooms, and providing pronoun pins. Oftentimes, those practices are done because an individual person voices that access need. if the person isn't able to be present at services for a while or doesn't have the capacity to fill out their access needs on a form regularly, I've seen a pattern of spaces discussing having the access need taken away from the space or not providing it because the person isn't there anymore or he didn't fill out the form. No, that puts the burden on the individual all the time by relying the access needs so much on that individual. Find creative ways to integrate access into everyone's fabric of life in the space, because the practices center disabled people and also enrich life for all the people in the congregation. It's about thinking beyond including a person that only asks who's in the room into collective liberation for all the people in the space. So I think the final way I would say for synagogues to grow is explicitly making connections between disabled trans justice to Jewish texts and Jewish values. I think a big influence on my work in this is my friend Cheryl Grossman, who was a disabled Orthodox Jew who passed away last year, who did a lot of work in advocating for disability rights in Orthodox synagogues. And one of the ways she would do that is give her sort of her take on the story of Moses. So there's a passage thinking back to Moses, Exodus, when Moses is called by God to free the Jews from Egypt. Moses says to God, "I've never been eloquent. I am slow of speech and tongue." And my friend would say, like, in the words in that text, like, you could view Moses as having a speech disability. And because Moses says he has always been this way. God's response to Moses here is, "Who gave human beings their mouths? Who makes them deaf or mute? Who gives them sight or makes them blind? Is it not I, the Lord?" And how my friend like saw that as was like, this was a big moment for her, because for her to show like disabled people are created in the image of God. And like her, everyone is like, if you believe in God or the spirits of the universe, because so long disabled people have been taught by like outside forces that like, you're not in the image of like the divine. And like, no, we are. And then like Moses responds to this again, like, "I'm not the right person for this." And Moses says, "What about your brother Aaron? You shall speak to him and put words in his mouth. I'll help both of you speak and will teach you what to do. He'll speak to the people, but take this staff from me in your hand so you can perform the signs with it." And my friend Cheryl was like, think of Aaron as Moses' disability accommodation. He's supporting Moses in doing the communication that God is asking to help Moses in fulfilling the vision of what God has asked him to do. That's an example of a way you can draw a connection to a Jewish text and of a Jewish story and connecting that to disability justice and disabled people's stories. It's connecting the disability justice principle of we are all whole human beings, and always we are inherently whole, to the Jewish value of all of us being made in the divine image of the spirits of the universe, whatever that looks like for you, that the universe did make us disabled and the universe did make us trans. So I would say those are like there are infinite variety of ways, and this is not exhausted, though. Those are three ways where synagogues can take direct actions in making that happen. It's not just about the ensuring collective access, it's also reimagining the way that we're reimagining spiritual life and the way we tell our stories.
Yeah, if we continue to talk about all these ways that synagogues could help with this, it would be a really long podcast, I would think.
Yes, it would be a long podcast.
And lastly, Neuro, how can our listeners learn about you and all you do beyond this interview?
Yeah, thank you. Again, thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed talking with you. I would say I think the best way that people can learn about me is to follow me on Instagram, which is where all my drag is. And my Instagram is at NeuroQueerCosmos, neuro as in neurodivergent, queer as in gloriously queer, and cosmos as in the universe. My show, Disabled Delight, has Instagram as well, called at Disabled Delight DC. And those spaces are where you can learn even more about my art and see any updates on upcoming shows. If any listeners live in DC, Maryland, Virginia, come out to shows. The best way to support local drag is to come to us in our shows and cheer us on. If you're a person who produces events and you'd like to invite me to perform and or be part of panels, my Instagram has my email where you can reach out to book me for events to learn even more about me. And you can also reach out to interview me for podcasts like this one.
Well, I really appreciate your time, Neuro. It was great to talk to you. Really was excited to learn about some of the really cool things you're doing.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been wonderful talking with you, too.
Thanks so much to NeuroCosmos for the conversation. To learn more about NeuroCosmos, please check out the link in the podcast description for this episode. Here at Autism Personal Coach, our clients are the experts, our coaches are the guides. The majority of supports for autistics are not helpful. They try to fix us, not support us. That's why many are confused when we say our clients are the experts, experts of their lived experience. Our clients are the experts for what has worked for them and about the things that they need and want in their lives. Our coaches first listen to our clients and then ask thoughtful questions, offer resources, and strategize with our clients so they can get what they need to thrive. Would you want a guide in your life to coach you to get the things you desire? If so, then visit autismpersonalcoach.com for more information. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Autism Stories. And if you did, if you could tell a friend, foe, or anyone you know about it so they could have the same enjoyable and educational experience as you when listening to Autism Stories, it would be very much appreciated. Until next time, I'm Doug Bletcher of Autism Personal Coach. Talk to you then.